Good morning. Welcome, everybody, to our new series of Employment Law 101. Delighted to be back joining you again. Today, for those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner at NPM Legal. We're a specialist business advisory, employment law, and business immigration law firm, is what I was trying to say. Delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning.
I feel so rusty. I mean, it's only been about 6 weeks, I think, since we last had a 101, but that break has just probably completely reset my brain. For those of you that have joined us before, you'll know that we record these sessions. You can access the recordings on Spotify, Amazon, Apple, and of course, the video recordings available on our website, NPM Legal. Everything we're talking about today is relevant as of the 4th of September 2025, and we're talking about English law. Nothing we talk about constitutes pure legal advice. If you're ever unsure, please take specialist advice, and we'll be happy to oblige. My insurer will thank me for saying that. As always, we absolutely welcome questions. If you've got any questions on this topic, please use the Q&A function down at the bottom because that just helps us manage the flow of questions. But I've opened up the chat to everybody. So anybody who wants to send a chat message to anybody else that we can all see, by the way, just use the chat function down below as you have done in the past. Right, what are we talking about today? Well, over the next half an hour or so, we are going to be discussing collective consultation. And really, that's just born out of a few different projects that we've been working on, Adrienne. Just the sort of business mood out there at the moment. We know there's kind of various different projects and change processes that are happening. So we wanted to talk about the basics in terms of collective consultation, when it applies, what practical steps you need to be thinking about, and some of the common pitfalls that we see as well. And what we want to end on today, as always, just some practical tips. How do you handle those consultations effectively, but in a fair way as well?
Yes. I was speaking to a client yesterday actually who was saying that one of her team members had gone, please, can I have some more positive work to do? So apologies in advance if we're talking about something that seems like very negative from an HR perspective, because I know that there's lots more exciting projects that people would much prefer to work on rather than going through a redundancy process. But needs must, I'm afraid. But just to reiterate again, this is relevant for right now, and of course we are facing some whole-scale changes really to the collective consultation process in the Employment Rights Bill that will come in later. It's still subject to consultation and change, but as you know, we've kind of brought you up to date before, and we will continue to do so going ahead. So there will be some tweaks to this process. But right now, 4th of September, I think you said, Peter, for anybody listening on Spotify, this is the law at this particular moment in time. So what is collective consultation? Most of you probably know the answer, but it's essentially it's the legal process that employers in the UK have to go through when they are dismissing a minimum number of employees, so minimum of 20, in a 90-day period. Essentially, it's about engaging in that dialogue with employee representatives before any final decisions are made. I think it's worth stressing that it doesn't necessarily mean you have to go ahead with redundancies. It means you must follow a process to explain your business rationale, to listen to the feedback, and to genuinely sort of consider alternatives. Because the whole point of consultation, whether it's collective or individual, is to explore ways in which redundancies might be avoided. Doesn't mean avoided altogether, although we have seen that happen, which is great. It may be that certain pockets of redundancy, certain roles, for example, can be saved. And that's what the consultation is about, is to have that two-way conversation with the employee representatives. So it's giving the employees a voice and giving them that opportunity to influence the outcomes.
Yeah, it's that influence point that's really important, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think just one thing to add in here as well is that the sort of the legal, one of the key phrases in the legal test is it's got to be with a view to reaching agreement. So this is about you going into this genuine consultation process to try to reach agreement. But I would say you've got to try to reach agreement, but you are not duty bound to do so. So ultimately, if you end up with the decision that you need to make, as long as you've gone through, you've heard, you've considered, you might have tweaked, made tweaks along the way, then you can still go ahead with your plans.
So just coming back to when this duty actually kicks in, when does the law say you need to actually start a collective consultation process? Well, bear with me because it's a little bit of a mouthful, but essentially it's when you as an employer are proposing to dismiss 20 or more employees as redundant within a 90-day period at one establishment. So there's a bit to unpack there. Now, dismissal includes not only straightforward redundancies, so what I would call like classic redundancy situations, but also dismissal and re-engagement exercises like fire and rehire. Now, again, to reiterate what you were just saying, Adrienne, fire and rehire is absolutely a key part of reform under the Employment Rights Bill. We've talked a lot about that. I think our last episode before the summer break in July was all about where we are with the Employment Rights Bill. So you can go and listen to our thoughts on that. But fire and rehire is going to be reformed. It's going to be narrowed right down. But at the moment, if you're in a process where you're looking to dismiss and re-engage in terms of contractual changes, that has the scope to kick in these collective redundancy rules, which sometimes comes as a bit of a surprise to some people. And it's a kind of unwitting trap to fall into to think that you're only talking about pure redundancies. One of the other sticking points we see is around what one establishment means. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the entirety of your business. So, if you're an organization that has multiple sites, so for example, you might have head office operations, you might have regional hubs, you might have retail outlets as well, combination of those different things, you're not necessarily looking at counting the numbers when you're looking at, are we dismissing 20 or more people across the entirety of your business, so the one legal entity. Instead, normally what you're looking at is the unit where employees are assigned to work. But it's not black and white. And that's why I say if you're ever unsure about this stuff, you do need to take some specific advice on it. There have been various cases over the years that have questioned this issue of what establishment, dug into what establishment actually means. And those cases have told us that it can be narrower or wider than you might actually expect. It's not always so obvious. Sometimes it comes down to how your business is actually organized, in terms of day-to-day working practices. So ultimately, you've always got to check, carefully about this. In terms of some of the questions, that we see, Adrienne, one is, well, just on that fire and rehire scenario and whether dismissal and re-engagement, whether fire and rehire always triggers collective consultation. I just wondered
No.
what you think about that. Yeah.
No, it's I think so say for example one of our clients comes to us and says we want to change terms and conditions. My first thought will be okay, so potentially are we into the realms of having to collectively consult? I mean just saying as well that employees and employee reps can sometimes be a bit baffled if you say we're going through a collective redundancy process when we're looking at changing terms. So, it is confusing for employers and also for employees. So we need to perhaps factor that into our messaging. But no, the answer is okay, so you want to change your T's and C's. Ultimately, what will happen if you don't get the employees to agree? And that's the key question as to whether or not this collective process is going to be engaged. Because if you say, right, we need to change T's and C's, but in actual fact, if people don't want to agree, then fine, we'll just have to live with it. We'll do it a different way. We'll deal with it by way of natural, what's the word I'm looking for? I was going to say natural wastage, but I'm not sure that's the right word. But when people just leave normally
Yeah, don't
and deal
know,
with it that
churn,
way,
natural
yeah,
attrition.
natural attrition, that'll
Yeah.
do. So if ultimately all your end objective is employees must agree or else their contracts will be terminated and new terms will be offered, then you're not going to be caught by this collective process. But if you say, yeah, it's absolutely critical that we do change the terms and conditions, and while we will try to seek agreement, if we don't get there, we will go through a fire and rehire process, then yes, you're caught by this process.
Yeah, because then that's the proposing to dismiss part, isn't it?
Right, exactly.
Okay, we have had a couple of questions. Actually, let's just deal with one of them because it does relate to establishments, and that's how does the concept of associated company relate to this one establishment premise? I don't think it does. I don't think you, when you're looking purely at establishments, whether you count associated companies within your number, not for these purposes. I think associated companies do play a part potentially in terms of redeployment opportunities as part of wider fairness of redundancies, but not in terms of counting the establishment
Yeah.
point.
Yeah. So separate legal entities are
Yeah.
what we're talking about in terms of
Yeah.
associated companies. Yeah. I
Yeah.
mean, I think it's at the moment, it's not even that you count the numbers within the same legal entity. So, you know, let alone looking wider outside the group.
Absolutely. Tell us about the process then, Adrienne. So what are
Oh, the
the five
process.
key steps in terms of what it looks like?
Okie dokie. Right. Well, the first thing, in terms of the not necessarily in this order, but one of the things that you are required to do, and where you're looking at dismissing as redundant more than 20, is notifying the Secretary of State, and that's this HR1 form that I'm sure loads of you will have heard about. And the reason that that's important is a failure to do so is will potentially bring criminal and civil penalties. Although all of you probably have been all over the news when we had P&O, we've had Citylink, we've had loads of other people where the process hasn't been complied with and nothing seems to have happened, but you don't want to be the first. So submitting the HR1 form to the Secretary of State is an important step in the process. And the reason that's actually done is so that this is what the understanding that I have is that it's so it can prepare the job centre for an influx of people who don't have jobs, might be applying for benefits, etc., all of that kind of stuff. So it's a preparation on the numbers.
I think
Second of
it's
all,
also, and I only learned this recently, but I think it's also Office for National Statistics data monitoring
yeah.
as well, actually, in terms of what the workforce looks like. But
Yeah.
I was chipping with that because that only came to my attention a few months back.
Yeah. Good. Sorry, second step, identifying appropriate reps. Now, obviously, if you've got a recognised trade union, then you're going to be consulting with the trade union reps. If you don't, you might have employee reps. Just make sure that the remit for which they've been elected by the employees includes redundancy, because otherwise you're going through an election process to say to the employees, right, you've got the chance now to elect employee reps, and then that body of reps is who management would consult with over the redundancies. And the reason why you can't submit the HR1 before the reps are in place is because the names of the reps need to be put onto the HR1 when you submit that to the Secretary of State. Third step, you've got to provide the key information in writing to the employee reps. And I think, sorry, just going back to the second step, you could be in a position where you have a combination of trade union reps and elected employee reps, depending on the scope of your redundancies. So you could end up with them all in the same room together, which would be quite interesting. But yeah, providing the key information such as the business reasons behind the proposals, what the proposals actually are, the kind of timeline, who's impacted, both in terms of number, categories of employees, and any sort of proposals for selection methods. And, you know, all of that's going to be subject to consultation. So the wording of that needs to be appropriate. Fourth step, obviously, it's all about the consultation process. So, as I've said before, it's about finding ways to avoid the dismissals, keeping an open mind. You know, people come up going, can we cut hours? Can we job share? Can we do this? Can we do that? Reducing the numbers and mitigating the consequences. Now, essentially, what mitigating the consequences means, it's a variety of things, including redundancy packages. It might be time off for interviews. It might be providing, outplacement support, a variety of things to assist the employees who are impacted by your proposals, to sort of move on, into other workplaces. And I think the key thing about this is allow enough time. So from our perspective, the planning phase, which we'll come on to in a minute, generally takes a lot, much, much longer than you think. And therefore factor that into your timescale. So don't go, hey, we want to have our new structure in place by the 1st of October, or and think you can do the planning in a couple of days. Very often the planning stage can take longer than the consultation phase. But remembering that the consultation has got to begin in good time, and at least, and I'm stressing the word, at least 30 days before the first dismissal takes effect, if it's between 20 and 99 people impacted, or 45 days if it's 100 or more. Sometimes the consultation goes quicker, just depends on your proposals, but sometimes it can take longer. So allow yourself enough runway to make sure that you can say, hand on heart, consultation has been meaningful, because employees, and particularly the employee reps, are going to feel really unhappy if it's been rushed and feel like the points that they've raised have been skated over.
Can I just jump in on something there? Because
Go on then.
it's I see it described a lot as a minimum 30-day consultation period or a minimum 45-day consultation period, and it's actually not, is it? I describe it as a mandatory waiting period between consultation starting and the first dismissal. And we've, you know, you and I have seen situations where actually, especially with the larger scale ones, a 45-day period where if the kind of background business context is relatively straightforward, like it's some kind of
Closure.
distress situation or closure, and it's really obvious to everyone, it can be the case that you run out of things to talk about. And so, you know, don't feel compelled that you have to keep talking for a 45-day period because you don't. You may do, but you may not. And if you don't, that's fine. What's critical is that people don't start leaving within the 30 or the 45-day period. Otherwise, you are then going to be in breach.
Absolutely. So, Peter's absolutely right. So, if you've got a situation where you're closing a site, for example, and selection isn't really an issue, which is generally where a lot of things become a little bit sticky, you may well run out of things to discuss with the rep. So you're moving into individual consultation, but even that might be exhausted quite quickly. It's remembering that it's the date that the employee leaves that's important, not the date on which notice is given, for example. So there was a case. Oh, I would say it feels like last week, but it is actually a long time ago, which confirmed that notice can be given during this pause period, shall we call it, as long as by the time you're giving notice that you're happy that consultation has been thoroughly explored and exhausted, and you can move on then, as long as the date of termination is not before the end of those minimum periods. Well, yes, and one of the questions we often get asked is, can the consultation process start before the HR1 is submitted, for example? Because, by the time, as I've said, the names of the reps need to go on the HR1 form, which would indicate that some sort of process can be started. Have you come across that?
And I think the answer is technically yes, because I think the HR1, although the HR1 form has to have the reps' details on. In terms of like, say you started consultation with those reps or had a first meeting on a Wednesday and then you didn't put the form in until the Thursday or the Friday, I think that's okay, isn't it?
It's fine, and very often, I think one of the questions on the form is, has this form been provided to the reps? And sometimes it can be, well, no, not yet, because we haven't started consultation. I think, well, from my perspective, what I always try to make sure of is that this minimum period of the 30 days or your 45 days starts to run from the date the form is handed across and is submitted, because in that way that you're safe. So you might have had initial discussions on consultation before that's done. But the actual official starting point of that period to play it safe is to make sure that you've got at least 30 or 45 days after the date on which it's submitted. But
I mean,
it's difficult to start doing a collective consultation with the body of reps, alone. You can't say you're consulting with the individuals because your consultation needs to be with the reps, right? So that's the starting point.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think as well that sometimes there's a lot of focus on the and anxiety from the business about the HR1 form itself and like who submits it, who's going to see it, is it going to be out in the public domain, do we really have to do one? And actually it's just a kind of, I always see it as almost like an admin thing that ticks a box, it satisfies the government requirements and it goes in and everyone kind of forgets about it really, because the focus then becomes about, you know, talking to those reps. So don't be unduly anxious about doing the form. Like Adrian said before, I think really the primary purpose of it is that the government is aware of whether it needs to redeploy any local resources, like in a local large employer, for example, that's going to be impacted, and for, you know, data statistical analysis as well. So don't be too hung up about it, but equally it's important that it is done and the information on it does need to be accurate as well. Shall I talk a little bit more about just the employee reps? Because that's something that is obviously quite critical in this as well. So if those of you that are joining have recognised trade unions, you will know that where you've got a recognised trade union, you consult with the union. You know, that's the purpose for which they're in place. But if not, then you are probably going to need to arrange elections for employee representatives. Where you might not need to is if you've got a standing body of employee reps who are not part of a trade union, but they have been put in place for the purposes of collective consultation exercises. Now, we don't really encounter that very often at all. And even when I have encountered it, it's still sensible to consider whether actually there should be like a fresh election for the purposes of the forthcoming collective consultation process. So if you're going to do that, you obviously need to arrange an election process. That process has got to be fair, it's got to be transparent, and you've got to allow affected employees the chance to both stand as a representative and to vote in that process as well. And there are some rules around what a fair process looks like, which we're not going to dig into today. Those reps that are ultimately nominated and elected then become the key channel for consultation. So if they're from the union, they're going to be the union reps. If they're elected directly from the employee body, they're going to be employee nominated representatives. Now, remember that you are also permitted to provide information directly to your employees, and you probably will want to do that in terms of the messaging flow, but the formal duty is still to consult with the representatives. So that's where you're having your meaningful consultation part, not directly with the employees yet. Something that crops up is, well, what if we don't have anybody who wants to stand as a rep? So you might be doing an exercise where it's 25 people, so not a large exercise, but it tips you into collective. What do you do if no one actually wants to stick their hand up and act as a representative? Well, the good news is that the duty on you as an employer is to just give the employees an opportunity to nominate and elect reps. If they choose not to, if nobody wants to come forward and do it, then you're okay. You've ticked the box in terms of that duty. So you've given them the opportunity to fulfill that function. So don't worry about that. But I think you'll probably find that you'll always have one person at least who wants to be a representative that you can talk with.
I mean, I think it's worth also pointing out that it's down to you as the company to set out the number of reps that you think you need. So that's always worth thinking about. So if you've got, you might say, well, marketing department will have one rep, finance will have one rep, sales is big, so we'll have three reps, and looking at it like that. So the other part we sometimes get is, well, that department hasn't nominated a rep. What do we do now? And you know, that I think that didn't that happen to you recently? If was that to you or was that to Mark? I can't remember.
Yeah,
But
I'm sure. I can't
yeah,
remember.
but you know, if you have a department that doesn't come back and put forward a rep because somebody may not feel confident or whatever, you can't just turn around and say, right, well, they'll represent you. It's a case of, right, are you sure you guys don't want to have a rep? This is your opportunity. But if not, we propose that marketing or you know, another department rep will act as your rep. Is that okay? And then they've got that opportunity. The other point I wanted to also add as well is that factoring into your timeline a ballot. So if you have, say, two people coming forward as reps for marketing, you might think, oh, we've got to hold a ballot because we've only said that there'll be one. It is open to you as the employer to say, okay, we'll have two. Because in certain circumstances, it will then cut down on some time or also the hassle and potentially quite an emotional thing for employees to think about where they have to pick somebody over somebody else when they're voting for a rep. So that's always a possibility. So I just kind of wanted to add in these sort of little bits around the side when it comes to the employee reps.
No, they're sort of important details. Let's just talk about the consequences of if you get it wrong, you interpret these rules incorrectly, you make a hash of it. Fundamentally, if you breach your duty in terms of collective redundancy consultation, then employees can bring claims for something called a protective award. And protective award is a little bit unusual in terms of tribunal compensation, because normally when we're talking about tribunal compensation, it is compensatory in nature and designed to put somebody back in the position they would have been, but for whatever the rule is that has been breached. So think about unfair dismissal compensation, and you're generally looking at loss of earnings. A protective award is punitive in nature, and it is absolutely intended to punish the employer. And what we know about what's coming online in terms of the Employment Rights Bill is that punishment is going to get a bit harsher. And this is probably a direct consequence of cases such as the P&O events of a few years ago, where the government have taken a view that some employers just take a calculated risk and factor the numbers and the potential financial exposure into their commercial calculations. And the reason for that is at the moment, the award is up to 90 days gross pay per affected employee. So that can spin up into quite a big liability quite quickly. But if you're a company with deep pockets, you might be willing to pay that. From April 2026, under the current proposals, and bearing in mind it's not actual law yet, but under the current proposals, from next April, that award is going to be increased to 180 days gross pay. So pretty much 6 months gross pay per affected employee if you get these rules wrong. And tribunals don't hesitate to make substantial awards if they feel that the consultation has been adequate. They'll basically start at 90 days or 180 in the future, and they'll work backwards as to what they feel is a fair amount to reflect the degree of failure by the employer.
I think it might be quite useful just to think about what we're talking about in terms of failure, because I think what I don't want is everybody out there to think, oh my God, we've got to run a perfect process. So one of the things that I want to say is that there is no such thing as a perfect process. So if you're, stressing about this, don't, because there are bits that are bound to go wrong. There's going to be curveballs that come in. They always do. So at the worst end, we're talking the complete failure to go through any collective consultation process at all. So no election of employee reps, no collective process with those employee reps. That's the kind of top end that we're talking about. So a total disregard for the law in this area is at one end. Then it's going to be things like, somebody may well have been missed off the list of those people who had the chance to elect an employee rep. So this is where it's important to gather up people on maternity leave or long-term sick, at least to be able to give them the opportunity. That's a potential wrinkle. Then possibly where you're going in with a fait accompli, obviously with a fait accompli and not listening, and this is much, much more nuanced because obviously your plans are going to be advanced to a certain extent because otherwise you wouldn't be going through this process. But it is really important to ensure that they are not, finalized to the nth degree. The I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, and you're paying lip service to this. So it's yes, you need to have your plans. Yes, you need to have your proposals. But you will need to allow for that room to flex and shrink and go through the consultation process in a meaningful way. It's where you go, we've already made the decision. We're closing that. Whereas, the requirement now is we're looking like we're going to have to close. And these are all the reasons why. So let's go into collective consultation. So, yes, don't think we've got to run it perfectly. Don't think you're going to come out the other side going, well, that was, we did that absolutely spot on. It never happens because life just isn't like that because we're dealing with people. So, but it's making sure that you've got the framework right and you're going in with the right approach to it. So I just wanted to allay some fears before everyone goes, oh my God.
No, I think that's very wise advice. It is an imperfect process, isn't it?
Yeah.
What about some takeaways then in terms of, if you're potentially embarking on an exercise like this in the next 6 months, what are the sort of things to be thinking about now?
Planning, 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 but only in terms of making sure that you're giving yourself enough time. Make sure that you're looking ahead in terms of your process. When it comes to the numbers as well, planning is also important because if you're picking a date, which is a potential dismissal date, don't forget to look back at the previous 90 days to see if there's any redundancies in that period because they will count towards the numbers. And also to consider looking forward for 90 days around your proposed date because that will also count as well because it's really important to consider that. And it's really difficult to do that, but that you have to factor that into your planning. And then when I'm talking about planning, think about the departments that might be impacted. Think about your employee reps. Think about the numbers. Think about, be clear on your business reasons. And then it's also things like planning agendas for meeting, planning all your documents that you need, and consider financial packages as well. I appreciate that companies who are in a position where they're making redundancies may not have the money to pay anything more than the statutory. And of course, that's completely fine. But if you are in a position to pay an enhanced package, consider how you might approach that. Will you be going through settlement agreements, for example, in which case it's helpful to have an agreed template. It's helpful to set up a process for that. Think about things like, are you going to offer training to your employee reps? Because it's important for the smooth working of a consultation process that the reps know what they're doing and they know their remit and they know that they're talking on behalf of other people. Think about how you're going to tell the reps to feed back to the cohort of people that they represent. things we always hear is employees feel very disconnected from the process if they don't have that constant connection with the rep who's going, right, I've been in this meeting today, this is what's happened, give me your feedback. It's so think about those communication channels. So it's not just you to the reps. How are the reps going to feedback to the employees? I think that's kind of an important bit. Keeping clear records, notes of meetings, having an agenda, marking things off that have been agreed as you go along so that you can make the most of the consultation meetings. What have I missed? Loads,
Just
I expect.
no, I mean there is so much, and we could talk for another hour probably in terms of all the facets of it. But I think, you know, what I would say is just being clear in terms of your communications with the reps and with employees as well. I think where I tend to see issues is where the employer's maybe not been so upfront, or it starts to create this atmosphere where the employee group are very suspicious about exactly what's going on. So transparency can really pay dividends, I think. And also not forgetting that collective consultation will interface with individual redundancy consultation. So don't neglect those individual conversations. We haven't really talked about that today because that's not the purpose of this session. But if you're interested in learning more about the individual redundancy process, go back and listen to our episode from April where we talked about the basics in terms of individual redundancies, and we may have touched on collective towards the end of that. Mindful of the time. So just to recap, obviously, if you're into collective consultation process, it's very structured in terms of this legal process and the set of rules which apply, totally different to the Employment Rights Act set of rules, talking about a different bit of legislation. But fundamentally, we're talking about ensuring that employee voices are heard in these large-scale change processes. You've got to notify the government, you've got to consult with reps, as we've said, could be trade union reps, could be elected employee reps. You need to provide information. There's this information flow, and importantly, it has to be meaningful consultation. If you get it right, you can reduce your legal risk, and that's what we're all about. But importantly, just maintaining trust within your organization as well, you know, maintaining that trust. Before we wrap up today, we have had a few questions which I'm very happy to talk to just before we close off the session. But I will say we're back in 2 weeks' time. So that'll be the 18th of September, same time. We're running right through to Christmas. Maybe a little break for half term, Adrienne. I don't know, probably, but we're going to be pretty much here till December, aren't we, in terms of these sessions? Let's just have a look at these questions. How can you stop an employee leaving before the 45-day period if they've found another job? Well, first of all, they're going to be required to give you notice under the contract. So that might use up some of the time. But secondly, it's about if you're terminating, it's about when you serve notice. And if you're making a payment in lieu of notice, you must make sure that if you're expressly dismissing, different to them just saying, I'm resigning now, you're in control. So if you're the one that's doing the dismissing, a redundancy dismissal, you just got to make sure that they don't leave within that 45-day
Well,
period.
can I just jump in there? So there's two things. You're giving notice, you control the termination date. If they want to leave earlier, the answer is no. If they still want to leave earlier, then they have to resign, but there's still going to be a notice period. But if they resign, then that's a different reason to redundancy. But ultimately, yes, you know, with the notice period, you control it. So it is really difficult, and I have some sympathy for employees who have found another job, but that's why it's important to explain to them why they can't leave before that date. And, you know, it is the way it is.
What's the process to elect representatives? There is a process to do it, but what I recommend is, and if you want to read any more on collective change processes, go and have a look at the ACAS website. They do have some really good information that's on there, and they've got one of their fact sheets, I think, which is all about electing, nominating an election of representatives, and it talks about your requirements to hold a fair ballot and how that works as well. So have a look at the ACAS website on that. Don't want to sound like that's a cop out. If you want to come and talk to me, by all means, get in touch. Elaine, hello, Elaine. In relation to P and O, what happened to the chap who said he'd see it out and go to court? Yeah, there's one guy who wouldn't sign the settlement agreement and said he was going to go to tribunal. I honestly don't know. I didn't hear any more about that. I don't know if you did, Adrian.
No, I didn't. I mean, it could well be that his case is still going through the tribunals. Let's face it, that wouldn't be a surprise. Yeah, I was thinking that actually when we were talking about it earlier, because I heard the P&O chap say the other day that yes, he appreciates he didn't follow the law, but he would have rather paid off and compensated the employee. So that is an example where they probably paid out for the consultation period. But I don't know. I don't
No,
know.
I'm gonna have to Google it now because you've piqued
Yeah.
my curiosity.
Yeah.
There's some chat in the chat sidebar about FAQs in these exercises.
Brilliant.
Absolutely.
Love
Like
them.
common questions, especially where you've got disparate workforce, people at different geographical locations and different reps, keeping a consolidated list of questions and even anticipating some questions and putting out what the company's stance in, absolutely invaluable. So
And keep them updated as you go along. And that's
yeah,
a really
like a
good way
rolling
of
spreadsheet is
disseminating
perfect, isn't it?
information. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely.
Hybrid, that's an interesting one. Sorry, I'm just diving in on that one
Oh,
when we're
yes.
talking about one establishment hybrid working. I'm going to be that typical annoying lawyer will say it depends, because it depends what how your business units are set up. We're not just talking about geographical locations, but it could be that they are one establishment. It could be that you have to look at the whole company. It just there are so many factors that would dictate that depending on who's impacted and what your setup is. So I'm sorry, I can't give you a more definitive answer.
Yeah, it depends. It
It
depends.
depends.
Right, we'll have the recording for this session out next week, so look out for that. And please do join us in 2 weeks' time. We'll update the Zoom link so it will show what the topic is ahead of the topic. So thanks to everybody that has joined us live today. It's great to be back in the hot seat doing these sessions, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. And in the meantime, let's hope the sunshine returns. Enjoy the rest of your week.
Bye, everyone.
Bye bye.